Guys, this is Uriah Faber, the California Kid, here with Greg Conley, serial entrepreneur, founder of Trifecta Nutrition. We're talking about everything under the sun, fitness, entertainment, and of course, business, making that money. The story behind how Johnny and I met is super random, too. Yeah. It's through a mutual friend.
Nice. Well, let's start with that. Yeah. How'd you guys meet?
So yeah, this is crazy. So introduction first, Greg Conley.
What's up, guys? Brothers?
And this is Johnny Martin.
What's up?
Also known as Johnny Martini.
That's right.
That's a cool name. That'd be a good fight name.
Really?
That would be a good fight name.
I think I'm a little old for that right now.
Yeah, maybe at the moment. But just a brief intro to Johnny. Johnny and I met through a guy named Tom Buggerman. Tom Buggerman got a hold of my managers in 2007 with an invention of some sort that he wanted me to be the face of. And he introduced himself as that, and then came at me later with a movie idea that he and I actually developed together, and got a little bit of traction going, and then it kind of fell off. And heard from him maybe once every 4 or 5 years, and I literally just got done filming and editing Green Fever, this movie, our first full feature movie, and I get a text while I'm sitting with all the guys, the directors and producers and everyone else at lunch, and I get a text from Tom Buggerman. It says, "Hey, Uriah, I don't know if you remember me," and of course I remembered him. He's like, "It's Tom. I think I have someone that wants to do our movies, or do our movie." And I'm like, "Dude, how serendipitous is this?" Mm-hmm. Where I'm sitting here finishing this first movie. Tom was the first guy to come pitch a movie for me, and he text me out of the blue saying that he has somebody that may be interested in producing our movie. And that day I was going to meet Mike Tyson. He's got a TV show, and we're doing all this different stuff. I had like a jam-packed day, and I beelined out in LA, which is hard to do, to go meet Tom Buggerman at his house to meet Johnny to talk about movies, and we instantly hit it off. So Johnny, with that being said, you're a guy that's done a lot of different things in the entertainment industry. Why don't you give us a brief overview? I know that you started out, I think, as a stuntman first, mm-hmm. and then made the transition to actor and then producer. What did that look like?
Well, I mean, basically, since I was a kid, I loved movies, and I loved Burt Reynolds, and I just wanted to be a filmmaker so bad, and I just figured how's the best way that I could be. I could go to college, I could, you know, figure out a way to learn everything, but to me, a film business is something you got to learn while you're there on the set, and so I thought, okay, I was an athlete, I played baseball, football, everything, and I knew I could do stunts easy enough, and I was crazy, and so I figured, let's get into that, I'll do a little acting, but it wasn't my passion. My passion was to be a true filmmaker, to see the award shows every year, and to know that someday that could be me, and it wasn't that I could fly off of cars and do all that stuff, but I figured that that would be a good road to take. So after about 250 features of being a stuntman, I turned into a stunt coordinator, where I had a five-year plan, and the five-year plan was to always progress and have a plan. After 5 years, no matter what it was, I had to leave that career. And so I was making good money, $400,000 a year, being a stuntman, and right at the fifth-year mark, I called it stop, and I went from 400 to zero, and then started my new career, because I really truly believe that you can't focus on a few things at once to become great at one thing.
So I was going to say, time out. 250 features as a stuntman, so that means you're jumping off roofs, crashing cars, catching on fire 250 times?
Yeah. It was the Titanic I was on that really kind of made me go, okay, where's the five-year mark coming? Mm-hmm. Because that's the one that really beat the shit out of me.
So, Titanic?
Yeah. Yeah, that one, I was the guy in the middle that fell from the top and hit the buoy and everything
else. Oh, man, that is a famous scene.
I actually remember that guy.
I see the resemblance. Crazy.
Your body getting ragdolled.
Yeah, that's what
falling
it was.
To your death.
So how does that work? Just so, because I know there's a lot of people that tune in that are MMA fighters or fans, et cetera, just basically tough guys. And that's kind of an industry. It's similar to the MMA space, where it's a little bit dangerous. It's kind of prestigious. It's, you know, it's shiny object. Like, that's a fun thing to do. You probably have chicks that love that kind of scene. And it's own. And Tom Buggerman was kind of telling me about, you know, that kind of world itself. How does it work? That's got to be hard. That's a union job most of the time.
Yeah.
The more dangerous a project, the more you get paid. Is that kind of the gig?
Yeah. I mean, we receive stunt adjustments. The thing is, though, it's really hard with stuntmen because, you know, the stunts have to increase every year because people get bored. It's like when you watch a big action movie, people don't realize it's a guy really flying in the air that's getting clobbered. They just move on with the movie.
Right.
So we become invisible at times. And then so the producers got the key of that and going, well, really, you know, we could get anyone to do it, even though guys are getting injured every single day and being pulled off and new guys are coming in. But it became more or less that, you know, a lot of the stunt guys weren't becoming filmmakers. They just wanted to do crazy ass shit.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that was the big problem of what I saw in the business, is that I needed to progress and learn more. And that made me a better stuntman. And it made me know that I need to know where every camera angle is. I need to know, you know, when the camera's pointing at me. And I need to know what emotion that I need to deliver so the audience could really see my performance.
So what are some of the biggest movies that you were on? You said Titanic. As a stunt guy, what are some of the movies that you were on that are pretty well known?
The Matrixes.
Oh, wow.
The Terminators.
Okay.
I designed all the action for Gone in 60 Seconds. I'm really a wheel man. I do a lot of car movies, from Italian Job. There's so many.
Check him out on IMDb, guys.
Yeah. So Wheelman, that's just your driving and all the crazy chase scenes.
I just love car, because that's how I got in the business. I met a guy who had Gone in 60 Seconds, the original movie in 73, when I was 8 years old at a car wash, and I saw that crashed up car, and I go, what happened to your car, sir? And he said, this is Eleanor, it's not a car. He goes, and I'm a director, producer, actor, stuntman, and a distributor. And he was all in one, and we sat down for 2 hours when I was 8 years old, and
wow.
He told me everything, and I said, well, I want to do that. And he goes, well, you come and see me when you're 18. And so I studied, I worked hard as acting, stuntman, and everything, so I could meet this guy when I was 18. And so I drove to LA at 18, and I got ready to meet him. And right when I got to LA, my mom called me and said, H.B. Alicki, it was his name, and he died doing Gone in 60 Seconds Part 2. He died with a cable slicing him in half from a gag when he was just directing the movie. And so I went to LA not knowing anyone.
Wait, that really happened? He got cut in half?
Yeah.
On set?
Jesus. Yeah, on the set. He saved his wife's life. And the funny thing is that I thought my career was over because I didn't know anybody. And really, 10 years down the road, I got asked to coordinate Gone in 60 Seconds. So it was like the man up in heaven made sure that I was taken care of. And now his wife gave me the rights to the new movie and all that. So it's all a domino effect.
So that's pretty crazy, the manifesting of things. So you met a guy, and I just talked to Coach Lee Kemp, he's the youngest world champion in the history of the wrestling world here, and he had an aha moment, kind of like you did with Dan Gable, who was one of the best wrestlers of all time, where he went to a camp, he was a 50-50 wrestler, he heard Dan Gable speak and heard a story, and it resonated, and he decided right then to go do something, go after it, and he became, you know, the youngest champion of all time, actually beat Dan Gable 5 years later, or 4 years later, and then went on to coach the Olympics, and now he's coaching at our team. But I think that's crazy when you're a young kid, like 8 years old, you hear someone, you speak of it, and they step away, don't ever think about you again,
mm-hmm.
but that sends your wheels turning and pushes you to be, you know, what you are today.
Yeah.
And so it just reminds you of how influential people are and kids are, and I've got to meet some heroes of mine, guys like, you know, Roy Jones Jr. and Mike Tyson, and even MC Hammer. I got to hang with MC Hammer.
Cool.
And those guys that I looked at and be like, you know, held on a pedestal, and now I get to be that for other people, and now you get to be that for other people. I mean, it's so cool the way the world works. I love that.
It sure mm-hmm. is.
That's cool.
Absolutely.
So then you get the stunt work. You say, all right, five hard and 400 grand. And what year was this?
Back in the early, late 80s, early 90s.
So 400 grand a year is a great living.
Yeah.
Especially at that time. I mean, right now even, but doing something that's so fun and cool. So you decide, all right, hard stop, 5 years. Was that a five-year thing that you actually said, okay, every 5 years?
Yeah.
And where'd you get that from?
Well, my dad always told me that you have to, in order to progress, you have to have a plan, a future plan. You got to stick by it, no matter how much it hurts, and no matter how much, if you want to stick with your plan, you have to. And so my goal was every 5 years, and it was a really important mark to hit, and it was scary. I mean, I went from having everything to having nothing for over a year because it took so long to develop who I was, my wife at the time, she thought I was crazy for doing it, and I was scared, and everyone thought I was crazy for doing it. I'd get calls where I could have continued to work, and great big movies coming my way, and I'd just turn them down, and when I had no money coming in But yeah. I had to, and it made me give me the energy of what I really had to push for. And that's when I became a stunt coordinator and did 75 films as a stunt coordinator.
Wow.
Won a few awards, like I said, in Gone in 60 Seconds, where I was able to coordinate and design all the action. And then after those 5 years, I knew I needed to get more into filmmaking, and that was to become a second unit director, designing all the action and shooting all the action for films. And directing it, and that was a great thrill. It was probably one of my favorite jobs, and I really didn't want to leave that. I really enjoyed that a lot, but 5 years came, and it was time for me to now become a producer, because I wanted to be a director, but I knew that no one would accept me as a director,
right,
being a stuntman. So I figured if I can make movies and make a profit for the financiers, I could show a way that now they could trust me, and the agents could trust me, because I'm a filmmaker now, to cast me in movies. So I went into producing. My first film, how I got in, was that this company, Millennium Films, did movies for 1.5 for the Sci-Fi Channel.
Right.
I went in there, I told them I could do it for $300,000, and they said it's literally impossible. And I said, well, what do you have to lose? You know, if I do it for $300,000, you got to complete a film, you fix it for $300,000, you still have half the money out. And they said, okay, you're right, let's try it. So I grabbed a few good actors, Casper Van Dien and Michael Rooker, and we did the movie, and it won Sci-Fi Channel of the Year that year. And
wow.
They gave me another one, and they wouldn't give me the 1.5. They said, okay, we'll give you 700. I won Sci-Fi Channel of the Year the following year. And then I quit that completely. They offered me four more movies, and I said, no, I want to do bigger movies. So I did three Cuba Gooding Jr. movies, which were about $6 million each, and made a profit. There's a way that you could guarantee a profit on movies. And started spin over. I got offered to go to China, to China Film Group, which is the government there. And they had a movie for $20 million that they couldn't afford to do. So I read the script, and it was not good. And I said, well, I could do this movie for $8 million. And I could show you. And so I met with 20 officials in China, and they made me sign a deal guaranteeing that I could deliver it, which I probably wouldn't have came home if I didn't.
And they're like, we'll chop off your hands, yeah, if you don't, but no big deal.
So I got lucky, and the movie came out really good, called Urban Games there, and I got offered a 10-picture deal there, but I didn't want to live in China, so
yeah,
came back home, and thank God I did, because then I realized that, okay, I worked in a company where I said, I'll produce this movie, but I want to direct it, and they accepted it, and Nick Cage, who's a friend of mine for a long time, accepted me as a director in Vengeance, a Love Story, that's out in Netflix right now, and then within 2 months after that movie, I got offered to meet Al Pacino and work with him, and he accepted me as a director for doing a movie called Hangman.
That's kind of that was kind of a dream of yours, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because I thought that that's where I'd progress, but really I'm finding out to become a real filmmaker and to make is becoming a producer. And now I'm starting to slow down a little bit as a director and go back to producing, because I think I found my niche of being able to, because it's a tough business, and you know, films aren't selling like they used to, and without blockbusters open, there's no way of selling movies. And so I have my niche still works somehow.
So real quick, if I can back you up, since this seems like something you're very good at, I mean, you saying you have so many profitable films, like, mm-hmm, break down that budget. Is a ton of it going to paying the actors? Is a lot of it going to CG and special, yeah, effects? Like, how does the usual, like, spread of a budget break down? I mean, I'm sure it varies depending on the movie, but...
Yeah, you were also talking about, and you've talked to me about it, and I've been learning the business for a while, like 8 years I've been trying to learn the business, and we've talked about it and whatnot. But you said there's a recipe where, yeah, things work.
Yeah,
you talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I get a lot of packages with budgets and all that, and usually I throw them away, and I don't usually meet with people that want to do that, because a budget is based on what the package is worth. And if people will look at it that way and say, well, I need this much money to shoot a movie, that's not how it works. The worth is when they come in and they say, okay, say we got Chris Pine, and it's an action movie, and we could shoot it in Georgia. So now I add up all those numbers where I know I'm going to get the incentive from Georgia.
The tax incentive.
Yeah, and then I know that how much Chris Pine's going to get paid in an action movie, and then I know what the overall sales. And basically the way you do movies is that you take what the foreign sales estimates are of selling the movie, which you could get a sales agent, and then judge what the rough amount is. I take the high, and I go all the way down the low, and I do about one-third above the low. And that way that's a solid number that I know I could count on. So now I take that number, then I take what the domestic buyout is. I don't take any risk. I take the buyout, meaning that I don't participate in profits with the studio. I sell it outright for, right, domestic and Canada. And so now I take that number, and then I take my tax incentive. So if it comes out to be $3 million, $2.5 million, and the tax incentive is $2 million, I minus that by $1 million. Now I know that's the budget of that movie. So now I guaranteed myself $1 million profit. The key in this movie business is to hit singles and doubles, and you'll continually make movies over and over again. But it's the people that take the risk that think their movie's the greatest thing. Because at the end of the day, we don't sell our movies, we sell trailers. Because it's like when you go see a movie and a trailer in a theater, and you're like, oh, I got to see that movie. It's going to be so great. And 85% of the time, it's not a good movie, and you guys hate it because your imagination has gone to such a high on where that story can go that you can't imagine that the decisions the director made weren't your decisions. So why would I want to take the risk of showing you a movie that you're probably not going to imagine what it is, and it's going to be something totally different? I'd rather sell you the trailer and let you imagine it, and now I'll sell it to you where I'll get a lot more money.
That's incredible, and I think it's funny because I've learned so much. I was just had a small part in the Rampage movie, which is a massive budget film, and I've been having aspirations of being a producer. We just produced our first feature film for a low budget, and I learned from Mark Schulman, who is actually – 3 Arts Entertainment. They did The Matrix. They're one of the producers on that, and they're managers and producers, etc. And I was learning so much about like the different makes. It's like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? How do you get things funded? You get things funded by attaching talent, whether it be a known writer, a known producer, known director, or a known actor. And a great script will attract great actors, and you can get the money once you've got all these pieces in place. Or you can get the money first, which will guarantee some actors. They'll say, well, show me the money. How much money do you have? The managers want to see that. How much money do you have in the bank? Oh, we're going to offer you this much to do the thing. They read the script. They say, okay, I'll do it. Now you, it's a bankable thing. If you have him and he's in, you know, Johnny was telling me about the pre-sale, like basically get your guaranteed money. That's the only way to make money in the movie biz. And the guaranteed money is based on, it's just like the fight game. There's guys that earn, put butts in seats and draw viewership. And then there's, you know, talented fighters. There's a difference, right? Sometimes they're both in the same, sometimes they're not. But the pre-sale has to do with, has an actor proven their clout that they can be worth some money in markets, in foreign markets, in local markets, whatever. And so I had a discussion on a movie that we're doing. Mark Schulman was trying to put together this movie, Beach Pizza. Craig Robinson, it's kind of a unique comedy and whatnot. And I was talking to an agent from William Morris Endeavor, and I was talking to Mark Schulman as a manager. And the manager can play part as a producer. They can play along with it. An agent can't do that.
Cannot.
They're not allowed to per the rules. So
that's like a legal law?
Yeah, it is, because then that means that they could get their actors to work for cheap and package their own movies and really messes with
it. It's all unions.
I'm sitting here and I'm
talking to my agent who's wanting to make it for $7 million and my manager that wants to make it for 1.7 in a tax incentive play, so it could be $3 million. You go to somewhere like Georgia and you get the tax incentive, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second. I'd like Johnny to talk about his studio that he has in Atlanta, and then, you know, spend $3 million, you get a tax incentive of 40 something percent of that thing, and then you've got a $3 million budget that only costs you 1.5 or whatever. So I'm trying to figure out the disconnect between the agent and the manager. The manager wants to make it for as cheap as possible, and the agent wants to make it for, you know, almost three times the cost. And turns out he gets paid on how much he can get for you and whoever else. So he wants to put other actors he has in it. He wants to use his writer. He wants to use his people. And he gets a fee as long as he gets them work. And that's $7 million. If he can get as many fees as possible out of that, then that's attractive to him. On the other side, here's my manager who can play along the profit side on the back end and help produce it, everything else. And he wants to make it for cheap as possible because that's how you make money. You make base hits and you know, sell it to distributor. So the two things I'd like you to talk about, Johnny, first off is, you know, what does that look like on the tax incentives, and why do you have a studio in Atlanta, Georgia, and why is everything going there, and what does the tax incentives look like? Because you said you have tax incentives ready where we can get the money right away. That's one. And the second thing is on the foreign distributions, how do those things work? And you know, how can you pre-sell in different areas? Like each area has somebody who's in charge of distribution in that side. And you told me before, like, you're guaranteed to get screwed on back end points from the distributors. You're never going to see the money.
Yes.
Is that kind of the way it is?
Yeah, I mean, the goal is, it's sort of like in any business, is that you would rather collect all the money and give someone else their side instead of the other way around. You don't want to trust somebody else to hold on to your money and give you a check after they've collected.
Gotcha.
And that's the problem with distribution, is that I collect all my money up front and I'll take all buyouts because then I know I'm going to get that money. But if I go into a partner with the studio, they're going to run through their books, their big attorneys and everything else, and they're going to charge me festival fees, which they're known for, of charging these outrageous fees. They never spent the money on it, but on paper it looks like it is. Then all of a sudden now my profit gets cut by 80%.
Yeah.
That's why you don't want to leave it in the hands of hoping that you're going to get this huge check. Yeah. It's sort of like a great example. Titanic made over $1 billion.
Wow.
When I was a stuntman, we had to sue them because we got no residuals hardly in that movie because they said they lost money. And it's like, how can you lose money when it cost $300 million and when it made $1 billion? They're like, because MGM owned it and Paramount owned it. That's two sets of books. So it's two sets of books that we have to try to get into, which will never happen. It'll take 70 years because their lawyers will keep pushing it. So here our attorney said, you'll win, but it's going to be 60 years before you'll win, and you're going to lose so much money. So that's why you want to take that away from them. Going back to your question about tax credits, with Blockbuster being gone and pirating going on, there's no way for a film to truly recoup, or no way to make a great movie, because you have to do it for so little that it's hard to make a great movie. So how do we make a good movie and still have enough money to do that? Well, that's where the tax credits. There's five states. There's Georgia, Alabama, New York, Ohio, New Mexico. L.A.'s is gone with TV. But if you use that, everyone has a percentage. Most of them are tax credits coming from the state. So that means that they'll give you money for every dime that you spend there. A lot of these countries, states are failing because we're getting more money than what we're spending there. So that was the whole goal of why we go to these weird states like Alabama and Louisiana, where you didn't even think about going there 20 years ago. Well, now Hollywood's there. Well, unfortunately, you know, a lot of the film art, like foreign sales, we can't shoot in New Orleans anymore because they don't want to see swamps anymore in movies.
Yeah.
You know, and there's not a pretty view to see in a movie from Louisiana. But but then you go to Georgia, where that's the new Hollywood now, because we're selling tax credits. So that means that it's a 35% incentive. We are able to sell those tax credits to some of the Fortune 50 companies, like Cisco and other companies, and they will buy those tax credits from us. So now it doesn't hurt the state at all. So this credit will last forever.
Can you explain why someone like Cisco would do that? What does that do for them?
Well, it's sort of like a write-off. It's like on my first movie, Vengeance, I sold all my tax credits to Matt Ryan, the quarterback from the Atlanta Falcons. He needed the write-off. He's making way too much money. He needs that write-off. So by buying the tax credits, you're able to use those credits and write it off and do it legally.
So he gets to buy for a discount.
Yes.
He'll buy the discount. So say it's $110,000 worth of tax incentives. You give him a deal. He buys it for $70,000.
He'll buy it for 89 cents on the dollar.
89 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
And so there's a margin. So that's crazy. There's hard to find loopholes.
That's high-level
so
business tactics.
There's some oil tax stuff that you can do, like if you're investing in an oil field, et cetera. And then there's the movie.
Yeah.
Tax, and then there's some vehicle tax stuff, but there's not many little loopholes anymore. It's getting harder and harder.
No, it's getting harder and harder, and the movies are getting harder and harder to sell.
I got a good art tax incentive that somebody told me they do. So you take an artist like David Garibaldi, for example. He's a Sacramento good buddy of ours. He's the one that did the mural outside of my gym. So if I were to, here's a tax little tax trick. If I were to take one of his pieces of art and I would donate it, I would, Super Sage Northcutt just walked in. I'm introducing him to Johnny Martini so we can make some action movies with Sage. Sage, come in here, man.
And networking's happening in real time.
So hang out, Sage. Just chill for a second. Yeah. We got this, Northcutt's in here. So
the artist.
Basically, the artist. So we're so a tax incentive would be, okay, look, we get this piece of art, and you buy it because it's not one of their top pieces of art, and then you donate it for what their art would be worth, and you get the tax write-off for what it was worth.
Do you have to donate? You donate to yourself?
Donate to a nonprofit or something else. So you donate a piece of art, say, hey, I bought this piece of art. Now it's worth, because this guy's art's worth, you know, $10,000. I got it for $1,000, but now it's worth, you know, this much money. And then there's a tax.
That's smart.
Especially if you're able to sign it and make it worth more money.
Exactly. Hey, you know who's been doing a lot of art lately? This guy.
Awesome. I love it.
So that's cool, man. I think people at home will you know, heads will be spinning when they start listening to this kind of stuff and realize, like, you know, that's the coolest thing about the fight game is when I first started in 2004, 2003, 2004, we're like, you know, inventing the way the roadmap. You come to entertainment and it's all laid out. Guys like you have learned when you're 8 years old, you meet a guy who tells you what to do and then you study up and it's laid out. There's unions and there's some guaranteed ways to make things and things like that. And it's so nice to have an established like industry versus what I was dealt with the fight world, and I had to create my own path. But this is really cool, and I've been loving getting to know this and everything else. So you got this tax incentive part. You've got the you know, the different parts of the moving things. So how does it work on each individual industry? Where, like, does somebody own the rights in a distribution? How does distribution work?
Well, I mean, that's what's tricky is that, you know, distribution, everyone's going to screw you, without a doubt. So you got to know going into it, how bad am I going to get screwed?
And how that's a great feeling, huh? Know,
and how little can I get out of this?
Young guys in the room, remember this.
So, you know, and that's the key to it, is limited. Everyone thinks that they got gold. Everyone thinks that, I mean, I had to push myself away by loving my movie so much, but being able to push myself away and forgetting about how much I love the movie and go now straight into the business aspect of it, to knowing that it's a good example is like when you sell foreign, it's like people will be so happy because France bought their movie for so much. Well, that's the wrong way of doing it. In our market, there are two places that are as big as Hollywood. That's Germany and Russia. So if I sell my movie to France and they offer me, say, $400,000, well, now Germany's going to find out that I sold it to France for $400,000. Now they're going to go off of that number, where normally if I would have went to Germany to begin with, they would have bought my movie for $800,000. Well, now they find out I sold to France, so now they're offering me $600,000. I just lost $200,000, because if I don't go to Germany and Russia first and have them buy my movies, they are the ones who are going to claim how much my film's worth in the foreign market.
Wow.
So that's the key, is that people get overly excited, and distribution, if you don't go to the right distribution, they will just sell the movie outright with whoever offers come in, and that's not how you want to sell it. And now, if there's a way that you could take your pre-sales and get a financier that'll hold off and say, okay, give me a year and a half to pay you back, instead of the year, which is usually it. So that way there, the loan, it doesn't override on the percentage of the loan. So you try to deliver movies within a year. But if you could get the year and a half, keep that pre-sale of foreign, and hope to God that maybe a studio will come in and want to buy the whole thing, you know, with a certain fee, and they own the whole world. That way there, you know your film's going to get a theatrical deal. You know you're going to get your money back because you pre-sold it the whole world to them. And then now you're going to be making a lot more movies down the road.
Right.
But when you sell to the foreign first, what that does now, it doesn't leave any money open for a P&A, which is print and advertisement for the studio. So when you see a lot of movies that go to VOD now, everyone thinks, oh, it just went straight to VOD. Well, that's 90% of the movies. And that's what people don't understand. They think it failed. It didn't fail. That's a guaranteed moneymaker. You'd rather your movie go to VOD than go to theaters, because theaters make 82 cents on the dollar of everything that comes in. That's why movies don't stay in theaters that long. They want them out of there.
Yeah.
So that way there they can make more money. And theaters are just for advertisement, for us to sell foreign better and to sell domestic better and all that. And so that's the key to really knowing what you have and how to not get greedy, and just hope that you're in a business where you can make your dream come true and make movie after movie.
Gotcha.
And not take a risk on it.
So I got a quick question for you on it, because Uriah, like, briefly mentioned this. Like, you obviously sat down and had that great conversation with that guy when you're eight. Like, let's say I'm not personally trying to do this, but I'm sure some of our listeners are. Let's say I'm trying to get into the directing game or the producing game. You know, you guys are in a unique situation where you're already, you know, famous, have money, you know, a lot of things a lot of people
Johnny's
don't have.
Famous.
Yeah. But, you know, you get the idea. Like, how does someone get started if they do want to be a director? Do they have to, you know, go the route you did, being a stuntman and an actor and all that type of stuff, or is there a way for them? Is it all just connections? Do they need to know the right people? How do they get into the game?
Well, I want to be a filmmaker, and if people wanted to be a director, it's a whole different route, because the way that I did it is a great way, and I got every dream I wanted to, every position I wanted to, but I got to being director when I turned 50. So guess what? This is a young man's business. The Hollywood kicks you out at the age of 65. Or 60. So I've left my career now as a director to be at the very end of it, where I'm not going to get the top cast, because the agents want that 25-year-old young director where they're going to make money on for the next 40 years. Top directors
like my buddy Brad Peyton.
Yeah, like Walter Hill and Simon West. All these famous directors can't buy a movie right now because their own agents don't want to give them an actor, because they'd rather give it to a guy who just won a little small film festival. And that's your answer to your question, is that I would say, listen, do a pet project. Show people what you could do with no money. Turn it into every film festival you can. Get as many awards as you can, and do it again. And if you do it twice and the same result happens twice, you're now going to get a name for yourself, and you're going to get better opportunities to get an agent. If you're not with CEA or WME and UTA, then it's going to be hard for you to ever cast a movie.
That's
interesting.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And here's on the other side of things, somebody that's been in every part of the movie business, and it's fitting we've got Sage and his brother here.
Badass reel,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
I saw your reel.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It was amazing.
Awesome.
So that, for example, I mean, it's obvious to me a guy like Sage Northcutt could carry a franchise. And when I say franchise, that's something like Jason Statham's done, where movies get made for him because he's who he is. You know, Stallone's a franchise. People can hold a franchise themselves. So if you take a guy like Sage Northcutt that is 21 years old and has something unique, and you want to build him as a director and a producer into someone that can carry a slate of movies, what does that look like? You want to couple him with the right actors, or find right movies that would, you know, put him in the right position, or how would that work?
Well, normally you're right. That's what I would definitely do. If I believed him, I'd give him a second or third lead and try to build him up that way. But you showed me his reel today, and it blew me away. And what I saw out of that reel, I saw trailer moments. And like I told you, trailers sell movies. That man, if I put him in a movie, he would have three of my moments that go into a trailer that are going to sell this movie, that's going to give him his own publicity. And that's where I would use him for. I would make sure that those flying flips that he does to a death drop would definitely be in my trailer. And
yeah.
So that's how I think I would sell him to become the next
I guess
actor.
It'd be different for every single...
Everyone,
and
yeah.
Does it pretty common when people say, hey, I got discovered, or, you know, somebody goes in like a Nicolas Cage. He's a talented actor, but he also had family in the business that gave him a big head start. How likely is it that people get discovered, and how much is it about connections and having something that's super unique and finding the right opportunities? Because I feel like what I've been learning is it's a lot about connections, but it's also about like likability and networking and people deciding like, okay, we're going to push this person, or how much is it just talent? Like this guy is so talented, like who's some of the most talented actors out there, like a Tom Hanks, for example. Like, he's just super uber talented. What do you say, like, how does it work?
Well, as a producer, I would say, please don't do this. But as a guy that wants to give a guy a break, I'll tell you, break every rule you can. That's the key. Being noticed and breaking every rule again. Sort of like when I was an actor, I was competing against everyone. I'm a shorter guy. They wanted a big bodyguard guy. How am I going to get in there? Well, I learned right away, okay, there's 100 people going in to read the same lines over and over again. The last thing I'm going to do is read those lines when I go in there. I'm going to know what they want me to say, and I'm going to create my own character from it. 9 of those directors are going to hate me for doing that, but that one will love me for doing it because it's different, and they're so tired of seeing the same thing over and over again that I got the attention of the one guy that gave me the job. I'd rather have that one job out of 10 than 0 jobs out of 10. So that's a thing. You've got to be able to be willing to break rules. You've got to be willing to step out of your own comfort zone and being different, you know, and that's the way that you're going to get attention in this business. You can't just be a great actor anymore. I mean, there's thousands of great actors. What makes you different? Nicolas Cage. You Google Nick, and every moment that comes up about Nick is his craziness.
Yeah.
That craziness makes him be able to be a star when he's making 7 films a year. Who else can make 7 films a year and still be a movie star? No one.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, and Tom Cruise, how did he find the niche? He was starting to drop. Well, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to do all my own stunts, and I'm going to show everyone. I'm going to jump off a 300-story building. I'm going to do everything so freaking crazy, and I'm going to cause more attention than my movie is.
Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Do you feel like, that's actually another question I was going to ask you, do you feel like that outside of the trailer and the posters and all the traditional press, like the press an actor is able to generate for a movie themselves outside of it, either doing crazy shit or, you know, someone like The Rock, who's got 100 million people following on him on Instagram. Is that a big component of why his movies can be consistently so successful? Because he's already super popular on social media. Everybody wants to be hanging out with him, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a big driving force behind it.
Yeah. You know what? I totally think that. And that's like when I met Uriah. What I loved about meeting Uriah is I could see him on film because he has a likability. I mean, you want to hang out with this guy. You want to talk to this guy. Thanks. And that's what The Rock has. The Rock has the same thing. And The Rock got his break because he had a big stage of wrestling, and people fell in love with it. Even though he was a bad guy, no one cared about him until he became a good guy in wrestling. And Uriah, I think that's where his notoriety is going to be, is when people start to get to know him more and get to see him more out there, people are going to want to see him just because they want to hang out with him. They want to like him.
Mm-hmm. Well, see. We'll see
speak,
about that.
Speak for yourself.
Now, we, cool. Just to talk about our project that we've got going. I met with Johnny, like I said, through Tom Bugerman, and I had an old film, like a script written 10 years ago, 11 years ago, it was Tom's concept. And then Johnny kind of had that conversation I was talking about, Sage, where you say, well, how do you actually make it not flop? Because it's a transition from one thing to the next is a difficult thing, and people do the wrong thing as they get eager and want to jump at whatever's out there. But you got to be launched correctly, right? Yeah. And so Johnny had a concept of his own, and I have like 5 different scripts. One in particular that I had written called Point Arena, and I sent him 2 of the scripts I had, one Saltwater and one Point Arena, and he loved the Point Arena one, and that's written about a small town up on the northern coast, and he had also had a concept of his own that he wanted to have written. So literally, you know, we said, hey, he wrote out a budget for Point Arena and said, yeah, let's work towards getting this. And then he wrote a script in like 5 days, and like 5 days after he wrote it, he had a bunch of interest in.
Yeah, I got a bunch of offers. You know what it is, that when I met Uriah, I did want to get into business with him. I was doing movies for around $10 million. And then I read what they wrote, and it was more felt like it was the worst thing for his career. And the reason why is because it was a fighter being a fighter in a movie. And I said, once you do this, you're going to be a one-hit wonder. So when I read Point Arena, it was a true acting piece, and it was something that was going to grab his attention. But in order to get there, we needed to do something that the audience does want, and that's a fight movie. But how do we give him something that's not going to just make it a typical movie that he's supposed to be doing? Well, that's why, you know, I read their script, and it was too action-y for me and too dated. It was like an 80s kind of an action movie, like a Van Damme movie. And so I didn't really attract to it. So I said, let me think of something. So it just started flowing. And I wanted to make a movie like Saw. And there's this old Japanese movie called Old Boy that they made an American movie. And it's just a crazy-ass movie. So you mix a movie like Saw and a crazy-ass movie, and you make it a character piece. The last thing I want people to say is, oh, my God, this is a great action movie. It's not. It's a character piece about 5 guys trying to survive. And they have to fight to the death with each other. But the moments really aren't in the ring. The moments are locked in this room, that they're chained to this room, trying to figure out how they're going to get out.
Yeah, building camaraderie, but having to face each other. It's kind of like the gym now, you know? Like, if you go into the practice, you got to watch practice today at the gym. And you got, in that practice today was Sage Northcutt, Chad Mendez, Andre Feely, Song Yadong, Cody No Love, myself. I brought in a bunch of heavyweight guys, and we're going for simulating death, basically, you know, ground and pounded chokes and whatnot. And you shake hands before, it's intense during. We get to walk away, but this movie is a little bit different.
Yeah, it is. It was important
on the line.
Important to give him something what Stallone developed. Stallone developed Rocky. Was that movie about boxing? If you follow the movie, I bet you talk more about who Rocky was and the streets he came from and the suffering that he had to do and the smarts that he didn't have to become something. And then you remember, oh yeah, and he won. But really, he didn't even win that fight. So that's what it was so great about. So that's what I wanted Uriah to do, because I really want to do his Point Arena script, because I think that that's something that's going to make him a known actor. So this movie here, he's the second lead in it, and I think, you know, and he really puts up his life to save another guy's life, because he's going to have a child, and really Uriah's character has nothing. So he's willing to risk his own life to save this guy's life. And now it becomes his character. So now when they're fighting, and the fighting to me is all about emotions. It's not about seeing all the moves. It's about seeing the expressions that this guy has to kill someone. Before, yeah, they fought and they're badass, but there's a moment where normally where they'd go really crazy and want to beat someone, to realizing that they're going to go the next step over. And now the expression in your face changed completely, because now you're actually going to kill somebody. And that's something that they're not trained for. And you can see a great fighter turn to someone that doesn't want to do this anymore right now. And it could be a real touching story and give him what he needs, I think.
Yeah. So how much of this has always been something that's made me like or dislike a movie. How much of the movie do you usually feel like makes sense for character development? Does that need to be a huge percentage of the movie? You look at something like... I don't know, like Harry Potter or something like that, where there's so much character development with those characters and people fall in love with those characters because of it. Is that something that you're always thinking? Because, I mean, them being chained to the wall and talking to each other and all of that, is that something that, you know, is kind of the backbone of really getting people to connect with those characters, is spending a lot of time doing that in the movie?
Yeah, I mean, the key to for a character, you still could add a lot of action, but it's like, say, in this movie, the more important thing is that you like these characters enough in the first 10 pages to where you don't want them to leave the movie. And once you get that, then you have two of them go out. You don't even show the fight the first time. You just hear the noise, and you see all five guys' reactions to what's going on out there, not knowing that they have to fight to their death yet. Then when one only comes back, now I've built all the characters up to where they're fearful and what's going on in their heads. Now I could go into my fight. So I'm not going to force fights down their throat. I'm going to wait to where they care about my characters before they have to see a fight. And I think that's important.
Yeah.
And Johnny, we talked about, he's established. I mean, he's done 20 movies and made money on each one, which is the hardest thing. And that's something that you don't see every day. And maybe you can run down some of the actors that you've made movies with that are, you know, of names. That says a lot when actors of that level will trust somebody to direct and produce, because their careers are malleable and precious, you know.
And they only have so much time.
They only have so much time. Yeah. So, you know, that being said, it's awesome that he would ask me to help produce on this, and we want to do movies, you know, moving forward. And I've been learning a lot about it. We've talked about it before. And having guys like Sage and access to guys that, you know, we can spot talent. And I always feel like, you know, I feel like that about Cody and Sage and a whole handful of people, Paige in the back in the past also. But having somebody that really knows the business and is like, oh yeah, like I just showed Sage's highlight video, which I'll post here probably pretty soon. And it's crazy. It's him speaking as a little kid and then moving into you know, what he's become and everything else. So we're excited about this. Get this first one done, get Point Arena done, and then hammer out some more movies.
Yeah, I just like to say that the key thing is meeting Uriah and knowing that everyone loves these guys, and then their career is so short that, you know, to be able to find a way to give them a career while they're fighting and give them a career afterwards, I think now's the moment that they need to start considering that, because they got their likability up. Why not carry that for the next 40 years instead of only the next 8 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's not just for the movie biz. I know if you look at, I spent this last weekend with Chad Mendes, and his passion is hunting. That's all he wants to do. He trains and he hunts. And, you know, he started a business. He's been doing it for a couple of years now, like almost 4 years now, where he does these elaborate celebrity hunts. And man, I had a great time with him, but I can just see him in his element. He's passionate about it, and it just feeds the hunger to perform and to do well in the fight game. But he's got a bigger picture building his hunting business, Fins and Feathers. So I like to see just people thinking outside the box anyways, because this is such a world where you can do anything. Yeah. And you're a testament to it when you talk about at 8 years old, you met a guy interested in his car, and that motivated you for the next 10 years to learn and manifest into foot in the door as a stuntman, into a stunt coordinator, into a producer, director. That's impressive, man. So thanks for sharing your story. Thanks, let me see how much time we got here. A little time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go so, for a few more minutes. Yeah.
So can you give us a rundown on some of the actors that you've had a chance to work with? And what that was like. Do you become you start out as a fan? Do you feel like a fan relationship at first, or is it something like you just feel like you're gonna get it done and it's eventually gonna happen? Like you just believe so much. I mean, what's it like working with some of these big name actors? And
yeah, I also want to hear at least one Pacino story.
Okay. Well, you know what? To me, every movie I do, I'm at what 330 films now. I still think it. The next one's going to be my first one. And so I get excited. I get starstruck. I love these guys so much. And I just wanted, I have so many questions for all of them. And, you know, I took the time to learn every actor that I'm with and, you know, and learn every character about him. And maybe that'll teach me something. But yeah, I mean, there are certain guys like Nick Cage who I'm best friends with. And I just love him to death. And I just love hanging out with him. And Al Pacino, I love hanging out with him. But yeah, I mean, I've worked with a lot of the top guys from Arnold, Keanu, Tom Cruise. I've worked with pretty much everyone, I think, somewhere in my career, which is nice. And, you know, just to find out why they're so good, it's like, take an example. Tom Cruise, I met on Interview with the Vampire, and he was a vampire. I mean, when we were at lunch, that man stalked us, and he was a freaking creepy
That's weird.
Individual. And you could, and when they called cut, he would eyeball everyone and just turn away, and he was never out of character. De Niro, when I did The Fan with him, he was never out. He was a psycho killer, and to be next to Robert De Niro as a psycho killer is the scariest thing that you've ever seen in life. Yeah. You know, and then you meet a guy like Nick, and he's, believe it or not, the opposite. He's the guy that's, you know, he doesn't believe that he's Nick Cage because that's not his name. He would always tell me, like, when we designed something, like, he goes, "What would Nick Cage do that?" Because he doesn't think he's Nick Cage. He's a normal guy that he knows that his fans like Nick Cage a lot.
He's got to be an interesting dude, man.
Oh, he's a trip. Yeah, he's a trip. But you know, working with the iconic Al Pacino, you know, to be able to do my second movie as a director and work with that man was unbelievable. And just the stuff I learned from him, it's like, you know, he would want to see me all the time. So I'm trying to prep a movie in Atlanta, and every 2 days he'd say, "Come over tonight." And I'd have to get on a plane quick and spend 9 hours with him at his house. And he'd say, "Okay, this character, the one that has one line, who's way off to the side, where's her family from? Or is her mom and dad divorced?" And he kept drilling me about these characters that were nothing in the movie. But when he got on the set, he would look at him in a way where he felt their pain, and he brought that little character out to life. And you know, and he was just telling me stories about when he wrote the Godfather that he did. Godfather 2, and he hated the script, but he knew he needed to make it. So he got a hotel next to Coppola's house and went with the writer, and Coppola wasn't welcome over there, but Al rewrote the whole script. But he couldn't do it without feeling that Coppola was close enough to acknowledge him, and he said he worked on it for 6 months, and it was just nuts, you know. You know, and of course, you know, I decided, you know, Al was sick on my set a lot, where I just told the cameraman, follow him with the camera wherever he goes. When he shows up on the set, just roll camera with a long lens and stay tight of him. I might use anything. And Al, you know, such a sweet man, but then all of a sudden he'd get mad and say and swear and hit something just off set. And I had it, and there's like 8 times in my movie that wasn't supposed to be in the movie, but I just actually shot it while he was just walking around.
Oh, that's so cool. That's a good thought process.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man.
I got one more question for you before we dive in here. Same question on the script side of the fence. If someone, I mean, you seem to know a lot about scripts. You know, you read the different scripts and said the things you didn't like. Where do people go about getting scripts? Is there like a peer-to-peer thing now that it's 2018 and there's just thousands of scripts out there? Do you have to have someone like Uriah bring you a script? Like, you know, how do you get, you know, a good script going? Because that seems like such a core piece of the entire movie puzzle.
Yeah, it is. The thing is that I could go look for scripts all day long, but it won't do me any good. I mean, what I do is I control five writers that I work with, and they know that the thing I could promise them, I can't pay them because it would cost me too much, but I will push as hard as I can, but I work in a two-year increment. I know that if I make a movie today, it has to sell in a year from now. So I got to be thinking a year from now what's going to sell. I can't be thinking I got the greatest script in the world right now. And I mean, sometimes you get lucky, but usually the studios own them and they trash them away just as long as they own them and get them out of the market, and they don't even make them. So it's hard to find a natural script. The best thing to do is to know what's coming, develop an idea with writers, and write your own script, and then be ahead of the game. That's the key to it. If you're making movies like Die Hard came out, if you're making a movie like Die Hard, guess what? 1,000 people are writing movies like Die Hard. But now, you know, I got to look at movies like, say, Get Out came out. Well, Get Out just started a whole new genre. Now I'm going to create a movie just like
Is that the black...
Yeah,
I watched that movie. That was a trip.
Exactly. Now I know where the direction of the film industry is going to go. And if I'm getting on the quick edge of it, I can write a script in 4 months, 3 months, and get on that pipeline where it's only going to last. Like, sort of like The Matrix is a great example. The Matrix was something that came out that no one's ever done before. Guess what? Everyone now has their action star running on walls now and doing the flexing thing and doing all that. Well, that lasted 2 years. And now everyone's got all these scripts they spent all this time on, and they're not worth a dime anymore, because you got to be careful also in scripts where they don't ever get dated and they don't ever get replicated. You know, so you always got to, I mean, it's sort of like our script where I took an action movie like Old Boy, which is a crazy movie. It's not an American movie. And then I took Saw. Well, everyone's still, today's movies, horror movies are doing well, but they got to be psychologically smart. So Saw is a very, very smart, creepy ass movie that you feel like you would be sitting in that room and getting stuck. And so that's the kind of movie that will always last forever, is a movie like Saw. So take that little piece of that storyline and then put in the moments that sell. Action sells. You know, thrillers don't sell. Westerns sell once every 5 years. So why even write one? Because there's only going to be one or two ever made. So you just gotta be smart enough to follow the industry and watch. I mean, I go to the movies all the time, and what I do is I sit in the back row, and I'll watch a movie three times, but I want the audience's reaction. I don't care about the movie. I just want to see how an audience sits. And when they sit and they lay back in their seat, I got their attention. When I got them looking left and looking right and looking at their clock or a phone all of a sudden lights up, I count how many phones, I know that that movie lost the audience. And it's really important that if an audience member stands up in their seat and leans a little bit forward to watch the movie even closer, and if I could get like 8 of those in a whole movie, that movie's going to strike gold.
Wow,
that's crazy. That's really cool.
I think
I feel like I know the whole industry now. I'm going to become a director. Forget trifecta. No.
So, just that little piece right now, and today in practice, we had Lee Kemp, who I talked about earlier in the podcast, who is a master of what he's done, and he does something, you know, as a wrestler, as one of the top 4 wrestlers in the history of the United States. He talks about something that's really important called micro moves, and it's just these little tiny adjustments and things. I feel like what you just described was like a movie micro move, where you're, you know, it's probably what sets you apart, is taking something as simple as going to watch a movie, watching it 3 times and not there for the movie, but identifying and seeing how a crowd reacts. I mean, that's a cool little thing that maybe you think nothing of it, but for me, that's pretty impactful, because it's the little things that count, and that's the way it is in mixed martial arts. That's the way it is in business, you know. What's going to set you apart? Attention to detail, a true passion, and you know, I also like about your story, one of the biggest things is that walking away from $400,000 in the 80s as being a stuntman, $400,000 a year, living a great life because you wanted to challenge yourself and go on a new journey and do more and feed to the bigger picture. That to me is super inspiring. So I think that's good to wrap it up. We've got some other things to do. We got to talk business. We got to meet your future stars.
That's
over here,
right.
and have the rest of the day. But guys, I hope you enjoyed that. This is again talking a little bit about business, about entertainment, about the Fight Game Nutrition. Greg, thanks as always.
Thank
that
you
was great. Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
Man,
thank you,
buddy. Yeah. Johnny Martini, Martini Films, coming to a theater soon. The true story. Awesome. The short guy that made it big. All right, guys.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.